The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello again. Thanks for being here for another Political Breakfast on WAVE. I'm Lisa Ram with political strategist Brian Robinson and Theron Johnson. And feeling a little somber to start today because I think we want to talk about how Atlanta is still reeling over the shocking death of MARTA CEO Jeff Parker. And Brian and Theron, I know you knew him both. You both knew him. And, you know, just quite a shock, right, to the weekend, to the start of the weekend.
Yeah, Lisa, I would tell you late Friday night, early Saturday morning, I was dealing with this very disappointing news about CEO and general manager of MARTA, Jeff Parker. Jeff was not only a friend, but also a client that I've worked with for many years when he was the Atlanta lead of the very well-respected firm HNTB, who is still a client of mine. And then I remember the day vividly when he came to me, Lisa, and he said, you know, my dream job is to become the CEO and general manager of MARTA. Can you help me, you know, get the job when Keith Parker, who you may remember, went on to Goodwill? And if you just look at his record, it's been very transformational in what he's been able to do at MARTA. But when we heard the news, it was just shocking because what it really sort of echoed to me is that you just never know what people are going through. And just to open up on this podcast, you know, I share with you and Brian, I mean, I needed, you know, every now and then I got to take a mental break. To be clear, I'm not having any suicidal thoughts, but you know,
but
this
mental
job,
health is real.
Yeah, yeah, it's real.
Health is very real.
And you know, the fact that he decided to do it the way that he did it, which was I know there are a lot of details still coming out about the death, but you know, there's been reported and you know, a lot of rumors, but it was reported it was a suicide. It just makes me sort of wonder, like, could I have done more? Could I have spent more time talking to him about something that he wanted to talk about? And so I think the message to our listeners is that, you know, number one, if you are having thoughts about, you know, harming yourself or others, please seek help. And I think the other message is that if we have loved ones and colleagues and people who we care deeply about, check on them and make sure that they're in a good mental and physical state of mind, but particularly mentally, because I think that while things may look good on the outside, particularly with people physically, you never know what they're going through emotionally and mentally.
Absolutely.
He navigated things at MARTA very well, and you just don't know, do you, Brian?
You remember at these moments that even people who have achieved lofty status in life, people who have achieved their career goals, who are respected in this community, and certainly he was, just held in very high esteem throughout Metro Atlanta for his tenure in office, the leadership that he showed. And what I remember about him, and Theron and I did work on the MARTA referendum in Gwinnett back in 2019, was he was just always unfailingly kind and easy to deal with. And I do regret that it happened the way that it happened. Not that there's a good way to commit suicide. And this, I hate that it was associated with MARTA and with, and in the public like that. And I think that just adds another layer of toughness to this situation. I don't know if this is true, maybe Theron can back it up, but you know, I had heard on Saturday as this was breaking that the family wanted the news to show that it was a suicide because they want people to know about the mental health crisis in this country. And since this is a political show, I think that Jeff's death could be a real push. It could be a story that helps Speaker Ralston get the $50 million in mental health funding that he's trying to get into the budget, put into the budget. I think honoring Jeff with something in the budget like that would be appropriate.
Yeah, I remember interviewing him about a year ago and just, you know, clearly this busy man, but just went out of his way to find the time to talk. So our thoughts, our hearts are definitely with his family today and tomorrow and the next day.
Yep, absolutely.
We're gathering a day after the King holiday and the annual commemorative service where the main focus of the service ended up being or centered around voting rights legislation. Thera, let me begin with you. How appropriate did that feel? How appropriate was that? You know, you had Ebenezer Baptist Church as the backdrop for this all-important issue where Georgia U.S. Senator Raphael Warnock is the senior pastor.
Yeah, Lisa, I was looking forward to it, and you knew it was going to be a theme, a reoccurring theme amongst the many speakers at this MLK Day service. I can remember as a young kid watching the service for 4 to 5 hours with my mom, and so it's something I look forward to every year. But I want to just kind of paraphrase something that Dr. Bernice King talked about. I mean, she talked about how, you know, if you really want to support my dad, her dad being Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., then just don't support or retweet or quote the words that he said, but why don't you embody the action that he called for? Why don't you do the things that he fought for in a nonviolent way? And so she talked about how the U.S. Senate has got to do their job, and that is to allow the American people to at least see the senators have a vote on such an important issue around voting rights. But she also, Brian, touched on critical race theory. And that was something that I thought that she was the most appropriate person to talk about, because when you look at Dr. King's life, there's so many things that you talk about, but just look at the nonviolent way that he went about to not just get justice for voting rights, but also just social justice and economic justice. And she said that basically, you know, don't hijack my father's work and then try to turn it around to prove a point around critical race theory. And the message there, Lisa, for me was that, you know, we as Americans, while it's as critical and as hard and as sad as it is to talk about, we have to talk about our history in its totality. And you can't just omit a very dark period, which was slavery, which was Jim Crow, which was, you know, discrimination and voting and women's rights. And so I think that she was very appropriate to make those comments. And then the other thing that really stuck out to me is that we all missed Happy Preacher. This was Elder Morrell, Lisa, who you know, who's at all of the different events. I know when you were reporting, he was at many events that you went to, and he unfortunately passed on the day that on the birthday of Dr. King. And then the last thing I would say is that I think someone said that, and this was a strong message to Republicans, you know, and I'm going to paraphrase, but basically, you're not allowed to post a quote if you don't want to give people the right to vote. And to me, I think that was sort of a very memorable quote that a lot of folks took away from this service on Monday.
I'm not going to surprise anybody when I tell you I have a very different opinion on all of that. And here's my thing. The MLK holiday is a national holiday. Every American gets to celebrate it. Every American can take the day and say, we have come so far on civil rights, on equal rights. We are still imperfect, but we are moving toward a more perfect union. And we are going to politicize and minimize MLK, who is one of the most important Americans in history. And certainly, you have to argue, the most important Georgian in history, maybe Jimmy Carter, number two. And he belongs to everybody now. When you become the subject of a national holiday, you belong to all of America. And there can't be politicians like Raphael Warnock who say, don't celebrate MLK, don't quote MLK, unless you agree with me on the politics of the day. That makes MLK smaller. He is not the subject of the politics of the day. He is timeless, as is George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, people that we celebrate throughout this entire country. And just say that you've got to agree with me on one particular bill, or you just need to go to work on Monday. You don't need to pretend that you believe in equal rights. It's offensive, it's wrong, and it further divides us. It balkanizes us. You know, only this holiday is only for certain people. No, it's not. It's an American holiday. It's for everybody. And, you know, I feel this angry about it because when I was Governor Deal's communications director, I wrote the speech the year that Deal got up there and announced we were going to build an MLK statue on the Capitol grounds. That was something that I had worked on internally in our office for a year leading up to that, something I felt very passionately about that we needed to honor the most important Georgian of all time on the Capitol grounds. And later that day, Raphael Warnock, not yet in the Senate, but the pastor, got up and bashed Governor Deal for not expanding Medicaid. Like in that service. It was the politics of the day. It minimized the day. It's wrong. And it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt going forward.
A lot of people were offended by Governor Kemp yesterday. He sent that greeting via video. But as you know, he signed the controversial voting law. That a lot of people feel amounts to voter suppression, and they just thought his appearance was a slap in the face. Any thoughts there, Brian?
That he wasn't there in person? Is that the issue?
Yeah, he sent greetings via video, but a lot of people, you know, they were offended by that.
Well, you know, here's the deal, and this is sort of the danger. This goes to my point. If a politician fears going to this event and being booed or being singled out and attacked on stage, which Governor Kemp had every reason to anticipate that may have happened. I saw what happened to Governor Deal, who was, you know, wasn't engaged associated with an issue that is much of a lightning rod back in 2014 as Governor Kemp is with the voting bill. So we've created a politicized atmosphere in an atmosphere that's supposed to be above politics. So of course, a governor going into his reelect is not going to create that visual, that image where he's being booed in that environment.
There's a lot of double standards that I want to unpack here. Number one, you can't say that Senator Warnock and Dr. King should, you know, represent us all. And if you hold those same standards to Senator Warnock and others, then the same thing applies to Governor Kemp. You and I both know Governor very well, Brian. He's not scared of anything. He could have actually been there in person, to Lisa's point, right? And the other double standard here is, got to go back to what Senator Warnock said in his remarks. He commended publicly and thanked former, and may he rest in peace, U.S. Senator Johnny Isaacson for never missing a MLK Day. And so if Senator Isaacson was good enough to come there every year, right? And he didn't always vote the same way that, you know, we wanted him to vote, but he showed up. Then I think the governor could have been there. And then, you know, you're the same guy that attacked Stacey Abrams for not showing up to a voting rally with President.
I didn't.
And Vice President.
I just pointed it out. That's all.
Yeah. So but you pointed it out. That's true. I want to say you attacked. That was a little strong. You're right.
No,
but you pointed it out.
I get why she did it, because his polling numbers are terrible. She doesn't want the picture.
But here's the thing I would say, Lisa, real quick, is no one is trying to hijack the holiday. No one is saying that this holiday is only for Black people. Let's just go right into the root of this. The difference is, Brian, is that Dr. King literally was labeled as a villain. Many white members of your party attacked him. They tried to destroy him. The FBI literally tried to label him as the most dangerous man in the world. It wasn't until he died that we understood what he really meant to this country. And also, let's point out something that Senator Warnock talked about as well. And I think this was so interesting. 49 states have introduced changes to their voting laws, right, in their states. But he said the commonality, the common thread that has been there is the same thing that many segregationists and people who try to divide this country back in the 50s and the 60s, they use the term states' rights. It's the same term that we're hearing a lot from our current elected Republican leadership, governors, lieutenant governors, senators, that are trying to change the voting bills. And so to me, what it is that you're okay to quote Dr. King. You can do that. And what you did with Governor Deal with MLK was monumental. But the difference is, Brian, I have some members of my party that do things and say things that I'm not proud of. And you have some members in your party that do things and say things that you're not proud of. And so I think, you know, when it comes to this issue of voting, I think the tone and the tenor of the message at Ebenezer was right on. They didn't attack anyone. And I just want to hear this same level of pushback and enthusiasm when Donald Trump comes out here or says something that clearly offends black people and brown people. I want to hear the same level of you know, I want you to push back on Donald Trump the same way that you're pushing back on Senator Warnock and President Biden when they say things that you don't like.
The latest Democrats' voting rights bill being discussed on Capitol Hill in Washington right now. So this is an issue that will continue, of course, and we will address it again soon. Want to take a quick break here because we do have a special guest joining us today. And when we return, we're going to chat with Georgia Republican State Senator Brian Strickland about everything that is happening under the Gold Dome and may happen under the Gold Dome. Stay with us and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
I want to welcome you back to this week's Political Breakfast, where we've been talking about voting rights and et cetera. And who knows the issues better than State Senator Brian Strickland, who's joining us today, taking a break from some budget talks today. We are so honored that you are here. Thank you for being here, and hello to you.
Yeah, thank you, Lisa, Theron, and Brian. Thank you all so much for having me. A very spirited conversation I heard y'all start with, and that's a great segue.
Yeah, we try to get all the body blows out before the guests come on. You know?
That's kind of what I was hoping. I thought about running away. I didn't want to get into all of this, but I'm not having a hard time.
Yeah, I saw you tweeted about the King holiday yesterday. What do you think about the service yesterday? Did it become too politicized, or was it right on with the especially the King family, talking about how important voting rights are?
Well, I know there's politics in everything. I'm not naive about that. But the way I look at that issue, I think that right now in particular, we know how bad things are nationally for the Democrat Party. So much so that I know Governor Kemp was criticized for not being there in person, but the vice president chose not to come in person. And I think it's sad that use that backdrop to talk about something that really is not a genuine thing to discuss here in Georgia. When you look at our voting rights in this state, if you pass the federal law, as the governor has said time and time again, other states will have to catch up to Georgia. Georgia actually has more, more early voting. We have more access to the polls than other states, such as Joe Biden's home state of Delaware, such as New York. And so I think it may be a thing to talk about voting rights. I think what should have been said instead is look at this state, look at the history of Georgia, look at the role Georgia played in the civil rights movement, and look how far we are today, and look at how expansive the voting rights are in this state. That would have been the better thing, just in my opinion, to say yesterday.
You know, Brian is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, and one thing I want to note about him, though, is I mentioned earlier in the show that I was part of the Dill administration. The Dill administration was very good to Brian Strickland. He perhaps benefited more from it than any other person at the Gold Dome. He started dating a former coworker of mine, then named Lindsay Perdue, no relation to the political family. And very early on in the Dill administration, Lindsay and I had worked together on the Hill for Congressman Westmoreland, and then both came down and worked for Dill. And so they have been married for, what, 7, 8 years now, Brian?
Yeah, over 7 years. You know, when I first got elected, I was a young kid, single, going to the state capitol, and my 90-year-old grandmother said, stay away from those women up there. First thing I did is I started dating a young lady, Lindsay Perdue, at the time, that was doing policy for Governor Deal. And luckily it stuck. We started dating that January, and we thought we were keeping a secret around the capitol. And of course, everybody already knew. And And then by that August, we were already engaged. And now we have, wow. We're married that following year. We have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, two little boys at home. So the rest is history.
Oh. One of the oldest is a doppelganger for country star Billy Currington. It looks just like him. I want to see the kid with the, I especially see the guitar, you know, boots and a guitar at any time.
Yeah, I hope he's got that talent and I'll be retired.
Yeah. Well, you got with some of the most controversial bills coming through your committee. Governor Kemp has come out and said he wants constitutional carry, which is a gun rights piece of legislation that I'm sure Theron's going to bash a little bit later. That's his job here. Tell us what it means. What does constitutional carry mean? And how do you see this playing out in this session?
Yeah, and so basically constitutional carry is the idea that you don't have to go get a concealed carry permit from a probate court to carry a gun. And this has been discussed since I've been at the Capitol. Frankly, I don't think the votes were there for this issue in the past, but a couple things have changed. The biggest thing that changed, one of the, other than dealing with unemployment issues, the other big complaint I heard from constituents during COVID-19 was access to the probate courts and trying to deal with going to get not just basic vital records you get there, marriage licenses, but trying to go get a concealed carry permit. And I don't fault the probate courts at all. They were backlogged with folks trying to go to their courts. Of course, they were trying to stay open with COVID-19. And that really highlighted the idea that why do we have people that wait in line and wait months to go get this piece of paper that says they now can carry a gun in our state? It seems like it's something that the probate courts shouldn't have to deal with. And it doesn't seem to make sense from a policy standpoint. I'm not sure who we're protecting by saying that law-abiding citizens that make the effort to go pay and go through this process can carry a gun in our state. And so that the bill was assigned to the Judiciary Committee in the Senate. There's different versions of that. Let me say that, too. You asked what it means. I have not finished going through the entire draft of Senator Anavatarte's bill, but he has that buried within one of his bills as other things dealing with firearms in our state. And so that's basically the gist of constitutional carry, but you may see some broader conversations, as you may recall, Brian, under Governor Deal, dealing with campus carry. When you start looking at gun laws in our state, the question is, will we roll back any other laws we have in addition to repealing the requirement of getting a permit?
Chairman Strickland, thank you so much for being with us. And don't worry, you're my friend. We get along very well, so I won't go at you as hard.
I will tell you, Brian, Theron said nice things. He said nice things behind your back.
Yeah, Theron's a great friend. We don't always agree on everything, but you've been great to work with.
Yeah, and we go all the way back to our Eagles Landing days. And now I know how Brian was able to get on the Georgia World Congress Center board, hearing that story between his former professional relationship with Lindsay. Ain't that something? The boys on the Republican side, they take care of each other. They make sure. Chairman Strickland, I'll stay on constitutional carry, if you don't mind. And this is just really, a question, because I know how hard you work to work with members of the other party across the aisle. So we'll talk about that a little later. But I would be remiss if I just didn't ask this simple question. I mean, I think at a time where we know that the country and Georgia, not just the city of Atlanta, but Georgia is experiencing a huge spike in crime, why should Georgians believe you and other Republicans who may support this? I know you're reading through the bill and I know there'll be different versions, but why should Georgians support a piece of legislation that basically gives more access to guns, where Republicans should be talking about responsible gun ownership to people who currently have guns? But how does giving access to guns reduce our public safety crisis in Georgia? And again, I want to say this, it's not just Atlanta. We have a gang problem in this state, right? And so how is giving more access to guns, and you talk about campus, and there are no checks and balances in place. There's no mental check. There's no process in place to even see if that person has tried to go the legal route and go through probate court. But why is this legislation, how would it actually help reduce the amount of crime they were having in the state?
Well, I think that's one of the positive things about the bill is it will, I think, help people with the rise in crime in our state. And you're right, that rise in crime is not just an Atlanta problem. It's happening across the entire state in small towns and counties across our state. But the idea, Theron, that someone that is going to go and commit a crime with a gun, someone that's going to use a weapon and rob someone, for example, that same person is going to go through the legal process to wait in line for months at a probate court to get their concealed carry permit first. I mean, I don't think those are the type of people. Someone that's already disregarding our laws is not the type of person that waits in line to get a permit. I think the other side of that's true. The person that wants to follow the law and just protect themselves, they're the ones that go through this process, and they're waiting months to have the right to carry a concealed carry, to carry a weapon and conceal that weapon. And I think it makes more sense to let those law-abiding citizens made to protect themselves and the people that are committing these crimes have that gun without permission from the state. And I know this is an argument that I heard with campus carry several years ago. The idea that if you allow any other weapons on college campuses, you put guns on campus, you're going to have more gun crime happening on campus. And I may have missed it, and you may be to provide an example of this, but somewhere in our state where that's actually happened since we passed that law, where we've seen now college kids all of a sudden taking guns and firing them at each other. And so I think the arguments against constitutional carry are academic arguments. Obviously, the idea of constitutional carry is an academic argument as well, of citing back to the Constitution, saying that, you know, because the constitutional rights of our citizens, you should never have to request permission from the state anyway. And so I'll look at the history just in my experience. We've dealt with these issues in the past. And I remember the speeches when I was in the House against campus carry, and we have not seen that. Instead, what you hear is you have kids, especially at Georgia State and at Georgia Tech, that now can carry a weapon with themselves to protect themselves as they go to class at night. And we just have not seen the, all of a sudden, the breakout of guns everywhere.
Yeah, it's a really scary thought. But I think the part of my question is, but how is it going to deal with the public safety challenge? Because where I'm going with this, Chairman, is like, given I'm still like at a time where the governor and attorney general say they want to reduce crime, they want to work with local leaders, they want to deal with gangs. How is this going to help reduce? Because you know this as a lawyer, a lot of these shootings and a lot of, you know, I know you probably don't do criminal law, but I know you have friends that do. A lot of these things are when people have access to a gun, and a lot of these people are acquainted, and it often derives from an argument, a dispute, mental illness. So when the governor and others the time be spent better trying to really work on our public safety crisis than giving people more access to guns? I'm just waiting for a Republican to tell me how we're going to deal with this public safety crisis that we have in our state. That's all I'm asking for.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I don't believe that constitutional carry solves our crime problem. I think it helps people protect themselves more from the crime. But you look at solving the problem of crime, you've seen other efforts already laid out from Governor Kemp in particular, funding, having more state patrol, funding the gang task force that you're going to have under the attorney general to take on gangs in our state. It's putting extra resources there in the budget for fighting crime. It's also making sure that people can get jobs. It's putting more money back into public education, back into our colleges. It's back into our technical school system. Obviously, solving crime is a deeper problem. So I want to be clear. I do not believe that constitutional carry is going to solve crime. It'll help people protect themselves in the meantime. But that's a much bigger conversation we have to have.
Criminal justice reform, very near and dear to you, specifically probation reform just last year. Anything new on the horizon there in terms of probation reform?
Yeah, and so when I gave the speech on the bill last year, I said, and it was Senate Bill 105 last year, I said this bill is going to be the most consequential bill of this session. Though I always told my colleagues, when you pick up the front page of the paper and read about last year's session, this may not be in the bottom fold. It may be somewhere dug deep within the paper. Hopefully it's reported on. But Senate Bill 105 in Georgia, before we passed that law last year, we had more people in this state on probation, not just per capita, but more people on probation than any other state in the country. And I got with some of my colleagues in late 2019, actually, and started having this conversation about why does Georgia have more people on probation? And what we realized is that in all the great work we did, especially under Governor Deal with criminal justice reform, we had a couple areas we had to go back and revisit. For example, we saw that there were over 50,000 people in our state before this law was passed that were eligible to be off probation. Probation should have been terminated, yet they were still sitting on probation. And so Senate Bill 150 that you mentioned streamlined the entire process of probation reform to make sure that those that we intended, those nonviolent offenders, those first-time offenders, folks that have done everything they're supposed to, paid their fine, served their time, that they can get off probation and not have to go tell a landlord they're trying to rent a house from, not have to go tell a potential boss that they have to take time off to go report to a probation officer. And so it's one of the many pieces that we continue to put together in our state of trying to make sure that people that are in the criminal justice system that want to get out, we actually give them a hand and help pull them out, people that want to help themselves and want to stop a cycle of crime in their families.
That's fantastic. And you've been doing a lot of work on criminal justice reform through the years. You were somebody who worked on that when Governor Deal was in office as one of his floral leaders. And so this is a culmination or a continuation, rather, of a lot of that work that's really going to make a huge difference for our state budget, but also in lives. I mean, this is about opening up doors, particularly at a time when we can't get workers, right? These guys on probation, these guys and gals on probation, we need to get into jobs for the good of society as well as for the good of their families. So thank you for what you're doing on that. And I think that dovetails well into one of the things that makes you unique in the General Assembly, that you've been there, first elected in 2010 or 2012? In 2012. And from Henry County, a part of the state that has diversified tremendously over this last decade, gone from a Republican stronghold to a strongly Democrat county. And yet in districts that were changing demographically very rapidly, you kept winning against Democrats in districts that Democrats should, you know, organically have a better shot at taking. There's no way Brian Strickland is a state senator today, having not lost an election, without having gotten a lot of non-traditional Republican votes. In this situation, probably a lot of African-American votes. Am I right? And if so, how did you do that? What sort of strategy did you have for bringing in Black votes to your campaign? And what does that, you know, tell the Republican Party in Georgia as a lesson?
Well, you know, when I first ran for office in 2012, it was Mitt Romney, Obama. That was getting all the attention at the top. And at the time, I was told I had a swing seat. And so right away, what I learned early on, of course, in 16, Hillary Clinton won my district in the House. And in 2020, Joe Biden won my district in the Senate. And what I learned is the best thing that I could do was stop trying to dive into all the national divisive noise, especially you see in those presidential years where it's us versus them. It's all red, all blue, no room for compromise, doubling down on things in those election years. And so I ran against that. I ran as a guy that ran on my record of things such as probation reform, criminal justice reform issues, supporting our technical college system, things that made a big difference to everybody on the ground. And then I got out there and knocked on doors, and I knocked on everybody's door. I knocked on people's doors that had an Obama sign or a Hillary Clinton sign in their front yard. And when I got to talking to them about the things that I worked on, I realized we agreed on most stuff still. I may have disagreed on some of these big national issues, but most people I learned, if you spend the time, most people don't like be put in a box that says you have to vote this way on every election. You have to think this way. As one constituent told me, I like to mix up my ballot. And so I'm going to vote blue at the top, but I'm going to find reasonable people that work across the aisle and get things done as you go down that ballot. And that's just my style. I've got two small kids. I got a law practice. Frankly, I'm too busy for all of the show that comes with politics. I enjoy the work. I enjoy diving into these bills and judiciary. I enjoy the boring stuff. But what I get to see in that and what my constituents get to see is I get up there and actually make a difference and actually deliver. And then my mailer I send out is not just citing the top three things that every other Republican mailer has in the country, things that had nothing even to do with that happened in Washington, D.C.
Well, you certainly have done the work when it comes to fighting human trafficking here in the state of Georgia. How far do you think the state of Georgia has come since the passage of the Anti-Human Trafficking Protective Response Act that you sponsored?
So far, and the biggest thing that we've done, of course, we've had year after year more laws that catch up with the activity in our state. You're constantly trying to stay ahead of the traffickers to get smarter, just like a lot of criminals. So they get smarter at what they do and work around your laws.
Right.
We've really had a big focus the last couple of years on the victims trying to come out of the industry. And I really want to commend Governor Kemp, and in particular First Lady Marty Kemp, for taking this on. It wasn't something they campaigned on in 2018, but it was something they learned about as soon as they got into office, and they've really taken this on. But the biggest thing, Lisa, that we've done is we made it okay to talk about it. I've noticed a difference. Just a few years ago, I couldn't go to an event and really get any reaction talking about human trafficking. Folks would stop listening. They would kind of roll their eyes and say, okay, that's happening in big cities. It's not happening here in our backyard.
Wow.
They didn't want to believe it. And so by talking about it so much, all of a sudden, then you're starting to hear about the busts that are happening right here in Metro Atlanta, outside of the big city even, in rural parts of our state. It's happening everywhere. And just talking about it makes it where people are now putting more resources locally into fighting it in counties like Henry now. Our sheriff here is taking it on here in Henry County. A couple years ago, there are folks in Henry County saying this doesn't happen here. And suddenly now we're starting to put our resources into battling it here on the ground too. And so we could talk about all the laws we've passed, which is great. But I think more than anything else, it's the conversation and talking about it that's helped uncover the crime more in our state.
Senator Strickland, Brian and I actually argue about this a lot. I say that we live in a blue state. He used to say that we were slight pink. Now he's saying we're purpling. But by every measure, I think it's fair to say that we're a 50-50 state. And yet Republicans, you know, still have, you know, a pretty sizable majority in both chambers. And now with a potential 9-5 congressional delegation seat split with redistricting. You just talked about how you narrowly won your district. And I know that that's a district that not only did Hillary Clinton win, but also Joe Biden won as well. But with respect to the shifting demographics in our state, particularly in your own district, how can Republicans reconcile this dynamic they have with voters of, on one hand, that you get caught up in a lot of the social issues, as you mentioned, with the former president, but it is, on the other hand, you know, you've worked with Democrats like Senator Tanya Anderson on record restriction bills. So how do you balance that in your district at a time where I think redistricting got a little bit more conservative, but you still represent a great deal of constituents that may not always agree with your party's principles?
Yeah, you stay the course. And I truly believe, and I've been a Republican since I could identify with a party. I mean, I found that when I first learned about the political parties, that the values of the Republican Party more align with me. But there are things I disagree with in the Republican playbook, and I'm sure there are things you disagree with in the Democratic book, if there was a book. And so I don't believe, as I said earlier, that anybody likes to be put in a box where they have to think a certain way based on the direction of one party goes. And so for me, it's just stay in the course and continue to be who I am. I mean, it's not always popular. I've been yelled at by Republicans as much as Democrats, maybe even more so at times. But what I've tried to do is just continue to be who I am. Obviously, you develop that confidence over time in your service. I hope I'm a better legislator today than I was when I first got to the Capitol. But, you know, the people have sent me back in these very difficult races based on my record. And so I continue to be visible in my community, talking about the tough issues and trying to offer solutions and trying my best not to bite at the opportunity to get into all the noise at the national level that just divides us so much. You know, this is, we all know that the way things work in DC, and it has for the last 20 years, at least since I've been following it, is one party gets in charge. The other party sits there and calls them names and attacks them until they take charge again. And it flips. They go back and forth. And it's fear and it's name calling and it's making sure that you must think this certain way or they're going to take this away from you. It goes back to the speeches at the church on the holiday, the idea that Republicans are out to suppress the vote. It's the same narrative that's coming out of Democrats right now. Republicans are guilty of that stuff, too. And so I just try to stay away from that and be myself. And as long as the voters will have that, and as long as some Democrats will keep voting for me too, then I'll keep doing this job.
We want to thank you for taking time. I know this is the start of the session, and it certainly is a busy time, a tedious time when you're doing the budget talks. But can you look in your crystal ball, and do you have any great predictions for this session?
Well, I think it's going to be a pretty quick session because everybody wants to get back on the campaign trail. That's obvious. As your listeners know, sure. Nobody can raise money during session that's in a general assembly, and the governor can't raise money during session. So there'll be a desire to probably get out of town quickly. But, you know, the great thing is I know the headlines will all be about, you know, the primary happening on the Republican side, of course, with David Perdue mm-hmm. getting in the governor's race. And then it'll shift to the general election this fall. Those will be the headlines. But I think you're going to see some really great things pass this year. We have a great budget the governor has unveiled that I think most Georgians are going to love. And the idea that we now, after 2 years ago, with record cuts we were making to the budget, now we're actually going to give money back to the taxpayers while fully funding, getting rid of all those cuts, fully funding our schools. You're going to see, as y'all mentioned earlier, I think us take on some really big stuff with mental health reform in our state, something that's long overdue. And so what I hope, in looking at the crystal ball, it's going to be surrounded by all the politics going on. Hope that people will stop and notice the great things that got done and will get done in this election year.
Senator Brian Strickland, thank you so much for taking the time. And we wish you well this session. Thank you so much for stopping by Political Breakfast.
Yeah, thank you all so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Great to see you. And let me finish with a quick story. A couple years ago, 5 years ago now, actually, my old
Brian,
boss.
You have more stories.
I know. My old boss, Lynn Westmoreland, was retiring from Congress, and that's the district where Brian and Lindsay live. And so, as anybody who's been in the General Assembly for a while does, is you look at an open congressional seat, right? And so, Lindsay asked me to meet with him just to talk about what a congressional campaign looks like and what serving in Congress would mean for his young and growing family. And what he said to me was, I'm not interested in having a title so much, because what concerns me about going to Congress is they don't seem to do anything. And in the General Assembly, I get to come in every day and I've accomplished something. I can go back to Henry County and the other counties I represent, and here's something tangible that I can do for them. And that is exactly the sort of public service that the General Assembly members provide. And that is how many of them approach it. You know, people call them politicians or whatever. These are public servants at that level. They make poverty wages and they do serious work, and it makes a difference for the lives of Georgians. So I just want to say thank you to somebody like Brian Strickland for the time away from your law practice, away from your family, that you devote to service to the state.
I think we all echo that. Thanks again for being here. And again, have a good session. Theron, did you have a story? Did you have something you wanted to share before we get out of here? I'm sorry. No, I should have asked you.
Lisa, look, I'm a registered lobbyist. He's the chairman of a very important committee. So I will leave it at that.
All right.
Well, I appreciate the kind words. Thank you all so much.
All right. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and most recently a senior advisor to the Biden Georgia campaign. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Good seeing you both. We'll do it again next week. Have a great day.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.